This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon by phone with Mark Gungor. Mark, can you hear me all right?
I can.
Very good. And you are in Wisconsin.
Green Bay.
Green Bay. We're talking about marriage and relationships. How did you first get interested in this topic?
Kind of interesting. I'm a pastor, and I was one of many pastors at a large church. And one day, the senior pastor comes in and says, "Look, we got to deal with marriages. Who wants to deal with them?" And nobody's hand went up. So then I went ahead and raised my hand and said, "Oh, I guess I'll give it a try." Literally how I got into it.
Now, you yourself were married at a young age. Tell our listeners when how old you were when you were married.
18 years old when I got married, and my wife was 19, and we've been married now for 35 years.
And are now grandparents, I read.
Three glorious little grandchildren. It's being a grandparent rocks, man. It's God's reward for not killing your children.
Now, you're a pastor in Green Bay at Celebration Church. What kind of a church is that?
It's an independent evangelical church. It's about 3,000 people attend on a Sunday.
And you've been pastor there how long?
For about coming on 2 years.
Uh-huh. Where were you before that?
I was in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I had a little church, about 400 people. Oh, I guess not so little for there, but yeah.
So a big change.
Yeah.
But you still have time to talk with couples about their relationships?
Yeah, actually, I travel all over the country doing a marriage seminar entitled Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. And on Thursdays and Fridays, we travel around the country doing that. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then I fly home Saturday afternoon and back for Sunday.
And you've recently published a book with the same title, Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. Why laugh?
Well, the laughing actually is about the learning process. It's not really about laughing in your marriage per se, though it certainly wouldn't hurt some people to lighten up a little bit. But let's face it, sometimes marriage is hard, and you don't necessarily feel like laughing. You'll be good not just to keep from strangling each other. But the laughing really is about the learning process. That's what I've got the title from. In other words, when you go to my seminar or you read the book or stuff, it's done in a very humorous way. The reason for that is when you can get people to laugh while learning something, they will remember it for a very long time. My seminar is very different than a typical marriage seminar where you go in and you get workbooks to fill out and all this other nonsense and stuff, you know. And at my seminars, you don't have to fill out workbooks. You don't have to have any breakout sessions. I call it the perfect seminar for men because you don't have to do anything. Just laugh, listen, and learn. But it's amazing. You can come back to people who have attended my seminar a year, year and a half later, ask them about the main points that I talked to them about, and they can rattle them off to you. Why? Because they laughed, or they were laughing when they learned it. And it's a powerful way. It's the same thing true, quite frankly, if you scare someone or you make them cry. It's this emotional thing. When you have an emotional connection to what you're hearing or seeing, you tend to remember it for a very long time.
Now, you say you're not an academic, but I was surprised in reading your book that you have footnotes and you quote from academics. You quote from people who do research. So you know that depression is a major problem in marriages.
Depression is?
Sure.
Yeah, it can be, but then if you're talking about that, it's not really a marriage problem anymore. It's a personal problem. It's a depression problem. I remain convinced that marriage problems are, in fact, the easiest problems in the world to fix. This is not rocket science. This is not that complicated. It's not people's fault that they're failing, quite frankly. I mean, if you don't know what to do, you just don't know what to do. But that's the problem. People just don't know what to do today. But marriage problems are the easiest problems in the world to fix. Now, if you have a personal problem, you have depression or a physical problem or some personal, you know, something in your head that's not clicking because of a bad childhood or whatever, it will affect the marriage, but at that point it's really not a marriage problem. It's a personal problem, and then somebody needs to get help for that.
I should probably explain, Mark. I'm calling you Mark because I'm not quite sure how to correctly pronounce your last name. It's it's spelled G-U-N-G-O-R, and you say in your book you're Puerto Rican. How should I pronounce your last name?
Like you'd say hunger only it's Gunger.
Gunger. All right. Yeah. Thanks.
And the Puerto Rican thing is, my father's Puerto Rican, my mother's Puerto Rican, but my mother and father divorced when I was very young.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my parents couldn't agree. My father wanted to have girlfriends, and my mother couldn't agree. And they got divorced, and then she remarried later, and then he adopted us and gave us his name. So I was actually born a Rodriguez, but my culture is a Hispanic culture,
uh-huh,
where I come from. So, yeah, I'm actually the Puerto Rican by blood, but the name now, Gunger, so it does confuse a lot of people.
And you were raised in Wisconsin, I read.
Yeah, yeah, in the middle of nothing.
Where'd you go to school?
Just the middle of Wisconsin, you know, high school and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And after that, as soon as I got out of high school, I got involved in ministry with various groups. We traveled all over the United States and Europe for 5 years and did some missions work. And by the time I got back from all of that, you know, we were already in our 20s and we had 2 children. And now I got to go to school to become a pastor. But they were just introducing, you know, this is back 1970, I don't know, 8 or something like that. Some of the universities were providing correspondence courses, so that's where I jumped in and got my degree with them that way.
Let's talk about some of the insights in your book and apparently in your seminars as well. I've not been to a seminar, but I've read your most recent book that was just published this year. Let's jump to the chapter where you talk about differences between males and females, between husbands and wives. You draw on a lot of interesting scientific studies.
Yes, yeah. Men and women aren't the same. What a shock. The reason why that seems to be so brilliant today is we live in a culture that tries to say that we basically are. You know, a man is no different than a woman. A woman's no different from a man, all part of equality and stuff. And while we're equal in that sense, the reality is, we are different. Men think differently. Women think differently. Our brains function differently. Socially, we interact differently. And that's what gets us in trouble, because the fundamental argument in marriage boils down to this one basic argument. Why can't you be more like me? I'm great. I'm fine. If you would just be more like me, we wouldn't be having the problems. And the reality is he'll never be like you. She'll never be like you. You'll always be you. She'll always be her. And you just got to learn to understand each other and where they're coming from. And when you understand why people are acting the way that they act, it changes everything while at the same time changing absolutely nothing. I talk about in my book a story about a guy who was on a train in New York City, and they came to a stop, and this guy gets on the train with his 3 kids, right? So the guy sits down next to the guy telling the story, and the train takes off. And the guy just closes his eyes and throws his head back. Well, the 3 kids are hellions. They're bothering everybody. They're hitting newspapers. They're just being nightmare. And at some point, the guy can't stand it anymore. And he says to the guy sitting next to him, "Hey, buddy, can't you take care of your kids?" And all of a sudden, the guy sat up and said, "I'm so sorry." He apologized to everyone on the train. Said, "We just came from the hospital. Their mother just died. I guess we're not handling it very well." Well, what happens? Everything changes in the train. In that car, everybody starts helping the guy with the kids, redirecting the kids' frustrations and whatnot. While the kids never really changed at all, the situation didn't really change at all, but they changed. Why? Because they understood the why to the behavior. When you understand, as Paul Harvey says, the rest of the story, it changes everything. And what I try to do is I don't try to change men and women at all. I don't think the key to a successful marriage is for you to be different or your wife to be different. The key is if you guys can really understand what makes the other one tick and understand it and support it and respect it, even though you may not like the behavior, it will change your relationship in a positive way.
Let's talk about some of those differences that seem to be part of our brain. You talk about the research that says that male brains develop differently than female brains, and as a result, men and women think differently. Talk about that a bit.
Well, I mean, the problem, for example, men tend to, I use the analogy of men's brains are made up of little boxes, and we have a box for everything. We've got a box for the house, we've got a box for the car, we've got a box for the kids, we've got a box for the wife, you know, and the rule is the boxes do not touch. When a man discusses an issue, he goes to the appropriate box, he slides it out, he opens up that box, he'll discuss the contents of that box And when he's done, he'll fold it up and put it away, being careful not to touch or disturb any of the other boxes. Now, a woman's brain, I use the analogy, is a big ball of wire. It's like the information superhighway where everything is connected to everything. And she'll talk about one thing, and she'll jump to the other thing, and the house is connected to your mother, and the mother's connected to the money, and the money's connected to your kids, and la-la-la-la-la-la. And she starts talking. She will jump from theme to theme to theme, leaving her husband in a state of confusion. What box are you in? What are you talking about? Because he doesn't understand that for her, everything is fair game, but for him, he tends more to compartmentalize. So it creates an immediate communication right off the bat. Then I point out the fact that men have one box in their brain that where a man has absolutely nothing in it. In other words, he thinks about absolutely nothing. I call it the nothing box, and that it drives women crazy. And the point of fact, and I point out to a study done by the University of Pennsylvania, I think, where they discovered that men have the ability to literally think about nothing and still function and still breathe and still be human beings. Women, generally speaking, cannot do it. A woman's mind never stops. She's constantly thinking about this, that, and the other. And when a woman sees a man sitting and thinking about nothing, sitting and doing nothing, it drives her crazy. And she comes to him and says, what are you thinking about? What are you processing? What's inside you? And he looks at her and says, well, nothing. And she gets so angry. I know women who get so frustrated at their husbands because they answer that when they say, what are you thinking about? They say nothing. And they're convinced that the man is holding out on them, that he's being evil in some way. But when in reality, he's just being a man.
The data that you give on that in that chapter is interesting. This is Professor Reuben Gur. I'm reading from your paragraphs on the nothing box and at the University of Pennsylvania, and you say that he showed that 70% of the electrical activities in men's brains shut down when they're in a resting state. 70%. Women's brains, on the other hand, Professor Gur says, maintain a full 90% of their electrical activity when they're in a resting state. You know, we can understand why that would be in terms of survival of the species. but as you say, it's very different.
Exactly. Now here's the problem, and here's what's interesting. When you talk about marriages breaking down in America today, 80% of all divorces in America today, as high as 80%, are being filed by women. It is the women in our culture who are going nuts. They cannot stand it. They are so frustrated with men, and they feel cheated by the men that they have, and they feel all because they bought into this over-romanticized or over-spiritualized viewpoint of marriage. And the reason women are so angry at their husbands is fundamentally for one reason. They're not women. We don't think like women. We don't process like women. We're not sensitive like women. We don't pay attention like women. And they get so angry. But I try to convince women, look, he's not a girl. Men make terrible girlfriends. And here's the point. You ask most women to describe their ideal man. Listen to them. They will describe another woman. Someone who loves to talk and loves to share. And what they, in essence, are describing their favorite girlfriend. But listen, my argument is this. Men make great husbands. They can make great fathers. They can make great providers. But they make really lousy girlfriends. We are men. We're not sick, twisted, broken perverts. We're just men. We're different than you. So I actually spend more time trying to get women to understand men than men to understand women. I have had it with these marriage seminars that beat up on men fundamentally for not being girls. And I've had it. There's nothing wrong with us. We're fine. We're just different than they are. And I think that women will be more happy when they understand how to communicate with a man, how to motivate a man, and understand that a man is okay if when he's just being a man.
Since we're two males talking on this program, let me throw the phone lines open so that we can have a female perspective if people choose to participate. And we are always eager on Keeping the Faith to include listeners. In Champaign-Urbana, here at the University of Illinois, there are several local lines. You can punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, wherever the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So that's toll-free 1-800-222-9455, and we have several callers. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on the air. Yes.
was wondering, when you speak about men and girls, are you speaking about girls as in juvenile women, or are you speaking about men and women?
Men and women. I tend to speak very sophomoric in general. I'm speaking about men and women, married people.
Okay, as opposed to girls and boys, or...
Yeah, well, a lot of these truths. Yeah, a lot of these truths probably do go back to boys and girls. I don't know that they were really that much different. But I'm specifically speaking now today as men and women, how women tend to think, how men tend to think, and the clash thereof.
Okay, so you never refer to men as boys.
Oh, sure, I do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay,
boys.
I just wanted to clarify.
Boys, girls, women, just whatever. Yeah, don't be quite so sensitive. It's all. The
I
same.
Just wanted to clarify. That's all.
Yep.
Thank you.
No problem.
But language does make a big difference. Let's
oh my
talk.
Gosh.
Let's talk to someone on the toll-free line, line number 4. Yes, go ahead, line number 4. Are you there? Line number 2. Here we go. Yes, line number 2.
Hilarious.
I'm sorry.
This is a very funny program.
Well, good.
Yeah. I have a question, however.
Yes.
I mean, I've been married to 3 of these guys that you're talking about already. Okay, and they're all very different, but do they, like, read the same book while they're pursuing you? That they then, like, I don't know what they do, lose the book? I don't know what happens.
Well, you know what, man? Look, it's not that it's, I in no way mean to even imply that it's the women's fault in this. I'm just telling you, women tend to be more frustrated with it than men. Men, or boys, whatever you want to call them, tend, at times, some of them are just idiots, you know? What they do is they have the sense of command and conquer, you know? They'll go out and they'll win the girl. And then they make this horrible fundamental mistake. They think I do means I'm done.
Yes.
And then the girl goes nuts because the guy's a moron. And I'm glad you brought that up. Let me tell you real quickly for all the men listeners out there and for you as well. This is what women want, and this is a big deal because for thousands of years, men have wanted to know what women want. And this is a big deal because most women don't know what it is what they want. But fundamentally this, she wants to be chosen. And that's what you're talking about. These guys go out of their way to choose you. And this is what women celebrate on their wedding day. This is what her friends celebrate
really?
With her and envy her at the same time because she's been chosen. How wonderful. And when will someone choose me? And so all of life is like the junior high school dance while she's standing on the other side of the room hoping some guy will come and pick her, right? Okay. Now, the problem again, these guys go through this and then they marry the girl and think, well, that's a wrap. Well, no, it's not. A man has to continually demonstrate that above everything else in his life, he chooses the girl. The man who will go out of his way to let a woman know that above all else, above my job, above my friends, above my interest, I choose you, will keep a woman crazy in love with him all of his life. The problem is today is guys don't get this, and they're blowing it, and women have had it. Does that make sense?
Well, I suppose when you're young, yes, that I get I suppose so. Let me give you an example from today. I hope not everybody in town recognizes my voice, but they probably will. Okay, so you say to the husband, hey, how about happy hour? We go sit under the tree and have some cocktails and whatever. And he says, the cushions are probably wet. Nothing is really comfortable. And this is the last place I want to sit. That's it. It's like, hello? Did you not just get invited out to cocktails? What kind of a response is that?
I don't know. Just a lot of guys are just very insensitive. I will say this. One of the keys to getting what you want from a guy, my dear lady, is just ask him. Tell him what you want. Women are very guilty of hinting at what they want, dancing around what they want, implying what they want. Now, here's the deal.
Okay.
If you were talking to another woman
uh-huh.
and you were to say something like that, she would immediately get the sense that, oh, she wants to spend time with me. She wants to talk. Maybe it's cocktails or maybe it's tea or whatever, okay?
Uh-huh.
But now you'll get mad at a man because you'll hint in a very obvious sense, hey, let's go hang out and spend some time together. He'll go, well, why would you do that?
Wait a minute. Now, your hearing can't be off, too. So How about at 5 o'clock we have cocktails under the tree? This is hinting around where he's not quite getting what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, what do you really want the cocktails or what else is it?
I honest to God want the cocktails. With that particular man.
I mean, it's not just about spending time with him?
Absolutely.
Well, I would come back to him and say, hey.
Oh, I see.
So I'd say, hey, Dumbo, like,
he
the
didn't
reason.
Get that part? He didn't get that part.
I want to spend time with you. Let's go spend some time. You know, if you don't want to, if it's too, if those cushions are wet, let's go somewhere else. Let's just spend some time together. Let's have some drinks and just hang together. And try and just make it a little bit clear. Guys tend to be so black and white and mechanical. If you say, let's go sit at such and such point, and his logical mind goes, well, wait a minute, that's a bad spot. The cushions are wet. And why would we do that? And things aren't ready there. Well, he's not going to get the point.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I still have to have a modicum of hope here that the book, the something, the well from which he drew forth what all of this brilliance when they were pursuing, you know,
yes.
that kind of thing that said that walked in the door and said, "Oh God, you look beautiful, and you also look tired. Sit down. Let me make you some dinner." And you're like, "Whoa, okay."
Yeah.
That it lives somewhere in there. it lives someplace. It wasn't like it isn't like women put it in there for that moment in time while they were trying to be chosen. They actually found it someplace. And I would like to believe that they are wise enough to hunt for it again and bring it forth.
Yeah.
Not a good...
It's just, again, what you're saying is perfectly legitimate. I'm trying to get you to understand a man's thing. And in my book, I try and show you how men think and how to get him. The reason a guy did what he did to win you in the first place is to win you.
Yes.
To get the... Men generally do things, not all the time, but generally they do things to get something.
Yes.
There's some kind of reward system fundamentally there.
Now,
I don't know you. I don't know your relationship with your husband. I know this from my wife.
It's great.
If she asks me to do something and I'm not paying attention, and then pretty soon I start paying the price, you know.
Absolutely.
She will start withholding some things from me. And,
oh.
and that can be a wide variety. But she'll tell me. She doesn't play the game.
This is hilarious.
She'll just say flat out, and then I go, I better do something about it. But now stop and think about this. Most women, and you sound like a confident woman, and I appreciate, I praise confident women. I think one of the problems in marriages is we don't have enough butt-kicking confident women in the first place. But if you're not a confident woman, and you hint at these things, hoping that he'll respond, but yet you continue to feed him, you continue to wash his clothes, you continue to take care of him, you continue to have sex with him. Where's his motivation at this point?
I don't know. I have to say I wouldn't dream of washing his clothes, and he is out at this very moment in time washing my car and filling it up with gasoline.
Well, God bless him.
He's being a wonderful man.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying,
yeah.
You know, at some point, a lot of women, they get absolutely nothing from their husbands, or they hint at them, they get very frustrated, but they continue to take care of them and service them at the highest level.
That's true.
And
that's
I think that's a confusing system to a man. I don't think you have to be mean and manipulative, but you just got to be very clear. Look, I need this from you. You don't want to have drinks. You don't want to sit down there. Then let's go to the but I need to spend time with you.
Right.
And if he refuses to do that, well, then somewhere there's a price to be paid. And I look, everything, like Dr. Phil says, everything in relationships is negotiated.
Well, thanks so much. You're just delightful.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Appreciate the call. This is Keeping the Faith, the live call-in program on WILL every Sunday evening from 5 to 6 p.m. If you'd like to call in and talk to our guest, Mark Gungor, that's spelled G-U-N-G-O-R, the author of Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage, just published this year, do call us, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, several local lines, and 333-9455. And incidentally, if you've missed part of this program or would like to hear previous Keeping the Faith programs, they are archived at the website of WILL. That is can be found at will.illinois.edu. Click on AM and then look for Keeping the Faith, and you'll see our past programs, including this one, which will be up in a week or so. We're talking with Mark Gangor by telephone. He's in Green Bay, Wisconsin, but he travels from there doing seminars on marriage. And we're talking about some of the issues in his most recent book. One of your most interesting chapters, I think, has to do with sex. And we can talk about sex to some extent on public radio. I was interested that you quote a lot from rabbis.
You quote
a book entitled Kosher Sex. And you talk about how in Orthodox Judaism, sex was never seen as dirty, but it was seen as a gift from God. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, just from, you know, you've got the Judeo-Christian ethic. When it comes to sex, the Judeos got it right, and the Christians generally don't. We've twisted it. We don't understand it. And what I try to go back by using a lot of quotes from this author. His name escapes me by the minute. Do you have it right there in front of you?
I do. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach.
Boteach, yeah.
Boteach.
He's actually he's a fabulous writer, and even had his own TV show for a while on cable. But he's brilliant. He's got this book called Kosher Sex. And from a very healthy and fabulous point of view, talks about how Judaism always viewed sex in the most positive of terms throughout history. And talked about sex was not ever treated as a, how do I want to say this? You know, in our culture, we think success is the pinnacle. You get to know someone, you fall in love with them, la 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 la, and then finally the big reward is sex. And what he argues, he says, you know, to a Jew, this is completely unintelligible. He says, no one in the Jewish community would even think that love is possible even without sex. He actually says that sex is a way for couples to fall in love, not the reward of being in love. And in my seminar, I point out that, you know, that a lot of women think that they think that you know, sex should be a side issue in marriage. You know, it shouldn't be a central issue. But in reality, it is a very central issue, and it is in fact the key to a man's heart. And I just paint that out. You know, they used to say when I was growing up that the key to a man's heart was his stomach, but they were about 6 inches too high.
You mentioned that the rabbis typically in apparently Orthodox Judaism would teach the males, the husbands to be, how to make sex very satisfying for their wives.
Yes, and a man was never allowed to use sex for his own satisfaction. In fact, the rabbi would actually sit down and teach a man how to bring a wife to orgasm. Man, can you imagine having that conversation with your pastor? I mean, this is a whole different way of viewing it. And sadly today, where it used to be men used to be lovers of women, men were cherished the role of being a lover to a woman and to satisfying a woman, both emotionally and physically. But today, in our over-sexualized culture and all this porn and all this nonsense, it has completely changed everything. Now, sex has become just a self-centered thing for the majority of men who, you know, the sexual experience is over in 90 seconds. I mean, women don't, you know, what was that? And I challenge men to start being real men. Sex isn't just about you. It's not about, hey, baby, come here, help me out here, you know what I'm saying? It's about being a lover to a woman, and the man who focuses on a woman and is a lover to a woman and can successfully satisfy a woman will keep a woman smiling a lot more than these guys who just use women to deal with their own immediate need. So it's a big point in the book. Actually, you mentioned a chapter on sex. I have 6 chapters on sex in my book.
And they start with, let's see, it's called Sex, Lies, and the Internet.
Yeah. It's a whole thing. What I come against is this whole idea that the key to great sex is lust, that the key to great sex is fantasizing and looking at porn or thinking about other women. It's all nonsense. It does not create great sex. It ruins people. People today you'd think would be having the greatest sex of their lives. The reality is people's sex lives stink today. It's awful for people. Why? Because of all this porn and all this lust and all this bad information we've gotten from our secular culture. And that is not the way to great sex. The key to great sex is when one man focuses completely and totally on just one woman, unlocking the sexual potential and energy in that girl. That, my friend, will lead to great sex. All this other stuff is pure nonsense. Your mama was right. Snacking will ruin your appetite.
When you first became a pastor, you and your wife had already been married for some time. You mentioned you were married at, I think, 18.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And had, I guess I'm curious as to how much your own, how much your focus on these issues of relationships grew out of your own relationship.
Almost none, amazingly enough. Well, ours is not a story where we were miserable and struggling and frustrated, and then I found the answers and am not taking this to the world. The truth of the matter is we've always had a fabulous marriage. It's been easy for us. In fact, you want to really get some people mad calling in? Check this out. I really believe one of the biggest problems in marriages today is people are, in fact, waiting too long to marry, and they are picking up so much bad baggage and so much negativity, and they've learned for 10 years, you know, from their 20s to their 30s, how not to keep their commitments and how not to stay committed and how to just use people. And then they get married in their late 20s, early 30s, and now they've got 10 years of really bad habits that they cannot shake. So while most people in our culture today would say, oh my gosh, you got married at 18, how horrible is that? The reality is I think the reason we've done so well is because we got married so young. As I travel around the country, check this out. As I travel around the country, almost unanimously, the people who are the most deliriously happily married for 30, 35, 40, 45, 50 years are the ones who got married at 19, 20, 21 years of age, across the board. It's virtually unanimous. Academics don't catch this, I do not know. I know they sit there and take these statistics and come up with blah, 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 but I'm telling you, the people who really get this one. Look, you can't even get to a 75-year anniversary if you got married at 35. You're dead, man. There's no way you can pull this thing off.
But it seems to be particularly tough for teenagers when they get married. Those marriages don't tend to last.
Not necessarily. Most marriages don't last, period. So it's not about the age thing. Looking at marriage as a defining factor, or the age, is just bad science. People's marriage do not end because they got married too young. They do not end because they don't have enough education. They do not end because they don't have enough money. That's all the statistics tell you. But it's nonsense. No one comes along and says, gee, you know, we're going great, but oh my gosh, we were too young, we better divorce. Or, gee, we were doing great, but you know, I didn't get a college education. What are we thinking? We need to get a divorce. People get divorced for one reason and one reason only. One or both of them get selfish, period. And you cannot convince me that 18, 19, 20, 21 years old are not capable of a commitment that will pull off marriage. Because there are young men and women right now in Afghanistan and in Iraq laying down their lives for each other. These are young men and women, 18, 19, 20, 21 years of age, who know how to make the utmost commitment. You cannot convince me that people are too young at that age to make the commitment. It's not about age. It's about selfishness. Now, can younger people be more selfish than older people? Yeah, but we're talking a few percentage points one way or the other. The reality is, if you'll do this right and you do it early enough, you grow up together. You don't have all this baggage. I haven't been a lover to 35 different women. I haven't been in and out of relationships with people. When the heat gets on, I don't know what it is to just break away from someone I was living with for a while. Why? I've been with the same woman all of my life. Our love, our commitment for each other started young, and it's blossomed all these years. I just don't buy into this whole deal of this extended adolescence that we've created today where, you know, it used to be people were teenagers from 12 to 18. Now you're a teenager from 12 to 30, 34. And it's ludicrous. And I think the biggest loser in this has been the men. I think that men today do not mature. They're not growing up. They're not becoming responsible. And all you got to do is talk to single women, and they'll tell you this. They see these guys 28, 29, 30, 34 years of age, still living with mom, who are still immature. Why? Because anyone who studies this stuff throughout any culture in the world knows that it takes marriage to turn a boy into a man. And in that case, I mean the difference between a boy, a young boy, and a man. Men do not mature without responsibility. And we've created a culture today where guys don't have to be responsible until they're almost 34-plus years of age and stuff, and it's been a disaster.
Let's go to another call, this time on line number 4, toll-free. Yes, you're on the air.
Hey, this guy is delightful.
Oh, I like you!
I was married to my first husband for dang near 20 years. It was a mess. We were married as kids, and he just had issues with being loyal, and it finally come to a point where we had to part ways, and there was another relationship, and that didn't last too long, and remarried again at 40 to the sweetest, nicest guy in the whole wide world. And what you said about making a woman happy, dude, you couldn't have said it better if you tried. If you take care of your old lady in the right way, she'll take care of you. It's a mutual thing. And I just wanted to tell you, you're nailing it to the wall and really enjoying the program. So
well, thank you. And see, it's not a result of the marriage. You did the first one young, but that didn't last. You did another one much older. It still didn't last. It's not about age. It's about exactly what you said, doing the right things.
Yep.
The key to a successful marriage is not following some statistical nonsense of what age or how much education or blah, 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 or finding your soulmate per se. It's about finding someone that you can do the right things together. If you'll do the right things, you'll succeed. If you won't, you'll fail. It's just that simple.
Yep.
Well, thanks, bless your heart.
All right. Later.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. You mentioned the idea of a soulmate. Many evangelical Christian writers and talkers and preachers really preach that. That
I know, they should
there,
be beaten with hoses, for crying out loud. It's a bunch of nonsense. Come on. Let's talk about faith here, keeping the faith. Do we really think that God Almighty created another human entity, another human being, just to make you happy? If that is not the epitome of self-centered, narcissistic thinking, I do not know what it is. God did not create another human being to satisfy you. The Bible never talks about love and marriage in the sense of a soulmate, ever, at any time, anywhere. Why? Because it's nonsense. It's not about finding the right person. You want to find the best you can. But it's about doing the right things. If you'll do the right things, you'll succeed. It's one of the reasons, quite frankly, and I know this is a faith-based program, but and this is going to sound weird coming from a pastor, especially an evangelical pastor, but you don't have to be a Christian to have a great marriage. I know a lot of atheists who have fabulous marriages. I know a lot of Christians who have terrible marriages, even though I believe they believe the right thing. Why is that? The atheist might be doing the right thing, and the Christian's doing the wrong thing. It's just it boils down to that. The reason the Bible never talks about soulmates, it just says, look, if you will live by these principles, the principles of love, patience, kindness, forgiveness, long-suffering, virtually any two people in the world can succeed with each other. That's how powerful the principles are. But we don't want to live by principles. We don't put these principles in our children. We don't value these principles in our lives. Therefore, it has to be more about the luck of the draw. It's the gamble. It's the rolling of the dice. Hopefully, I'll find my soulmate. Find that one magical person. No, it's not about that. It's about doing the right things. And in my book, I show people what to do. If you'll do this, I promise you, I guarantee you, this will help you succeed.
We have another caller waiting on line one to speak with our guest, Mark Gunger, the author of Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage, published just this year. Line number one, you're on the air.
Thank you. We've been married for 50 years, and I want to say we have lost our way to marriage.
How old were you when you got married?
19.
Yeah. See, it can be done.
I know. Thank you for this program.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. So you have another testimonial.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, I got lots. You get me going. I won't shut up. Just what that lady was saying about, 50 years. Oh, my gosh. And you know what? You want to add another different twist into this? One of the if you look at the one thing that has helped keep our culture together, our homes together, in the culture of all this divorce that's going on, you know what it's been? It's been the presence of grandparents. Okay, these wonderful people who step in and help out with the children and help these couples struggle through their deal. Well, look it, we're on the verge of heading for a disaster in this country. I'm 53 years old. I've got three glorious grandchildren. Fabulous. One of the most wonderful experiences of life. Number one, waiting for a long time to get married. Number one, you will rob yourself of that wonderful experience. And secondly, and more importantly, you'll rob those grandchildren. Because if you're 35 before you get married, 35 before you have your first child, and your kid does the same, dude, you're going to be 70 years old at least before the first grandchild shows up. And then by the time they're 10 years old and life gets hard for their parents and they fall apart, You're in your 80s, man. You're not going to have the physical, financial, emotional strength, assuming you're even there, to mean jack squat to those kids. And there is going to be hell to pay in this country. This delayed marriage, this self-centered, narcissistic thing about, well, I got to go party and have fun and find myself for 10, 15 years, there is going to be hell to pay in this country when there are no longer any grandparents around to help keep the structure together. And what's going to happen is everyone's going to have to lean on the state, and we know what a great job they do, and it's going to be a mess. We have got to change the way we're thinking.
We have another call on line number one. Other callers may call us at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Line number one, yes.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I guess I was dovetailing with this idea of marrying earlier, and I completely agree with the idea of fertility being a problem when you marry in your 30s and start thinking about kids in your mid-30s. But for couples who marry in their teens, it seems to me we have to rethink the idea of family support, because they are not in a financial situation to be able to really move ahead. They need to have some help while they finish their education or whatever. And
brilliant, brilliant. You are absolutely brilliant. You're hitting it right on the head. And that's the problem. We don't have that. In fact, I know families who threaten their young people. If you marry too young, I won't pay for your college. I won't support you. They create a self-fulfilling prophecy where these kids go through hell, the parents refuse to support them, it forces them into where their marriage breaks up, and then the parents go, see, I told you should have gotten married so young. I mean, how dumb can we be and still breathe? In our family, the family that I come from, man, virtually everybody in our family marries before 20. I can't hardly think of one in our family that doesn't. And divorce is virtually unheard of in our family. Nobody gets divorced. You know? Why? Because we have a family structure. We're there for our kids. Just because you're married, why do you quit supporting your kids in college for that? That makes no sense. Hey, well, I want my kids to do better in school. Well, check it out. Most studies show that the married students do better in school than the single students. You know why? Particularly for the men, because they're finally getting sex. They can think about something other than women for 5 seconds. I mean, so at every level that you look at this, this is asinine and insane to threaten and push our kids to delay. It's too expensive for them to marry. Are you kidding? It's more expensive for them to live apart. None of this holds. And all we do is create a self-fulfilling prophecy that is helping to destroy our culture today.
Well, yeah, I guess my point would be that if we could, for those families who could assist kids getting through college and avoid these hideous loan debt loads that happen when they're starting their careers, they're just such a huge advantage to moving forward with their families.
Exactly, and that's why we do it. It's all about the family structure. Oh my gosh, there's so many things that issue even brings up, but without the family, it's virtually impossible a lot of times to pull this thing off. And I don't care what age without that, so family is extremely important. He's dead on right on that one. That's great.
Thank you very much for the call.
You know what? And I would even go so far as this. My advice to young men today is, and this is general advice because it can't always apply, but my advice is this. You want to live in L.A., marry a girl from L.A. You want to live in Chicago, marry a girl from Chicago. Quit this nonsense of marrying some girl from Denver, dragging her to Chicago, 1,000 miles away from her family. Because it creates an environment that makes it difficult for these couples to succeed. And any man listening to me, any young guy listening to this program, listen, dude, you don't want to drag this girl away from her emotional support structure, because she will stick a straw into your brain and try and suck all your emotional energy out so that you become her sole source of emotional strength, which a lot of these people think that's what should happen. That's nonsense. The reason that these women should stay close to their friends and to their sisters and to their moms and stuff is so they can have an emotional support structure separate from the man. There's not a man created on earth designed to meet all of the emotional needs of a woman. And in a culture where we take these girls, we drag them millions of miles away from their family, and then the guy can't keep up with all these emotional drains and all this structure builds and this tension, and things fall apart. There's a reason why couples are struggling today. It's because we're doing the wrong things. It had nothing to do with age. It's just all the other things that we're doing are wrong, and we're creating a very bad scenario.
When you talk in your book about doing the right things, particularly in communication, one of the values that you emphasize is to seek to understand before seeking to be understood.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty idealistic, though, isn't it?
So how does one get beyond being concerned for themselves?
Oh my gosh! There's all kinds of things that you can do. We offer a great program. It's not talked about in the book, but if you go to our website, laughyourway.com, we have these great tools that help people to discover themselves and find ways to truly explain the why behind why they do what they do and what makes them tick. The reality is, if you would meet the basic emotional needs, not all the emotional needs, but the basic emotional needs of your wife, she's going to be happy. If she respects the basic emotional needs of your life, it's virtually impossible for you not to be happy. And check it out, neither one of you has to change. But most people don't even know what those are. So if I were to ask you or most men, what are the five things your wife loves the most about life, most guys would go, I don't know. And if I did the same thing for women, they'd go, I have no idea. Now stop and think how crazy that is. We get married. We spend all this time together. We try and build lives together. Yet most people, even after 40 years of marriage, cannot answer that basic question. What are the five things your spouse loves the most about life? So we have programs that help. There's a great little online test that you can take that help you discover these things. This is what's important to me, and this is why it's important to me. And if couples will just start to understand instead of just trying to be understood all the time, it would go so far to removing the tension in marriage.
We're talking with Mark Gungor, G-U-N-G-O-R, the author of Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. The subtitle is Unlocking the Secrets to Life, Love, and Marriage. Why are these secrets? Why aren't they better known?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people listening right now thinking, oh my gosh, are you saying I'm just a big loser? No, a lot of people don't know what to do, but a lot of you, it's not your fault. It used to be people would learn these things from their parents and from their grandparents and their family structure, again, the structure I was talking about. But we're at least, three generations of wackos in this country where our parents were so dysfunctional. Who wants to listen to them? And the grandparents, they were whacked out. And so we have generations now grown up today who've been married for some time who they just don't know what to do. They don't have any point of reference. That's the purpose for the book. That's the purpose for the seminars. It's not that this stuff is hard, but when you don't know what to do, it's very frustrating. And what I do in my book, it's not real spiritual. It's not real heavy theology, or even though I quote from some studies, it's still pretty light on that stuff. What I just do is show people this is how you do it. Here's how a woman can get a guy to do what she wants to do. Here's how a man can keep a woman in love with him his entire life. It's not that complicated, but when you don't know, you don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we come from families that they didn't know, who came from families that they didn't know, and we're in a big mess today. I'm telling you, there's reasons why 50% of divorces in America, or marriages today, are ending in divorce. We just aren't doing the right things anymore.
In your book, you mentioned an article by Naomi Wolf in New York Magazine that talked about a Muslim couple, or I guess a Muslim woman.
Jewish woman, actually.
Oh, was it? I thought it was one who said only her husband had seen her hair.
Yeah, this is a very fundamentalist Jewish culture where it's like that. Only the husband can see the hair; otherwise, it's hidden all the time.
I see.
And what she writes about, and here's a woman. This is not, she's not writing for Focus on the Family. I can gather that from all the F words she uses in her writings. But she, she's pretty much, a very hardcore feminist liberal woman who is writing saying, you know what? What's the most attractive thing that she was noticing is where couples make this whole intimacy, this whole sexual bond between them, exclusive, where it's not about lust and it's not about fantasizing. And she writes of this friend who only her husband would ever even see her hair. And she said she could just sense how intensely she felt about this man and how that exclusive environment created for all this incredible sexual energy. I use that as an argument in my book and to why it's better to just focus on one woman and make her special. That's the key to great sex, not looking at porn and all this other nonsense.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the specifically spiritual or religious values that you talk about in your book, and one of the big ones is forgiveness. You end with that concept. Why is that so important?
Because even though you go to my seminar, and I hope you all do come see me sometime, or buy my book, go buy the book, or buy the DVD, whatever. While I can show you all these things and you can learn all these things, which is a starting point, the reality is nobody does this right. Nobody does it perfectly, I should say. Everybody makes mistakes. We all hurt each other and will be hurt. And if you don't have the fundamental element of forgiveness in your heart, you will never survive a marriage. Because when you get two people that close to each other, you're going to hurt each other. As wonderful and as great as the love can be, sometimes so can the pain and the hurt. And you've got to be able to walk in forgiveness. And why that's so difficult, particularly of people of faith, I don't understand. I mean, forgiveness is supposed to be Christianity 101. We pray the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Well, the reality is people don't want to forgive people who sin against them. And they need to. It's really our key to forgiveness in our own personal lives.
How does that show up practically in a marriage?
Well, you got to be able to forgive each other. You know, if you constantly remind your husband of his failures, if you constantly say, you know, you did that to me. Remember that time you wouldn't do this, and you hurt me, and you were flirting with that one girl, or you forgot to bring me flowers, and you keep shoving it in his face. It will destroy a marriage. Forgiveness lets it go. Forgiveness covers it. Forgiveness fundamentally just stops talking about it. The key to real forgiveness is not in your head. You might remember what that person did to you to the day you die. It's not in your heart. You might feel the pain of what that person did to you to the day you die. It's in your mouth. True forgiveness means you shut up. You quit talking about it. The people who walk in forgiveness know what it is to stop reminding each other or talking to their friends or to their moms or to everybody else about your failings. People who walk in true forgiveness, they shut up, and it brings healing in life. I have hurt my wife in many ways over the last 35 years, but that incredible woman has never once reminded me of my failures, never once reminded me of the times I hurt her. Why? Because she walks in forgiveness. I know that when she forgives it, it's over with. She lets it go, and then life can come. But if you refuse to hold on to that principle, if you want to instead hold on to your wounds, hold on to the transgressions of others against you, constantly rehearse them out loud, you'll destroy your marriage, and you'll kill yourself, by the way. I mean, people who live like that don't live very long lives.
We have another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Yes, line number one. Go ahead. Oops, not quite ready. Just a second. I think now maybe we have line number one. Yes, go ahead, please. Line number one.
Taking my phone call.
Yes, please.
I want to suggest an alternative to Mark, some of his ideas.
Sure.
And that is the reason why we see marriages breaking down is because of economic stress and economic insecurities that get kind of embedded in families. And if you look at it from a class kind of perspective, to a disproportionate degree, families that are becoming dissolved are families that are economically struggling, that are poor, that are low income. And this is an issue that you haven't talked about at all. And I think that ties directly to the new economy of America and the new economy in our communities. And the new economy is one of post-industrialism, where jobs don't pay as much as they used to. And this creates stress, and this creates some real problems that families have to deal with. And that creates kind of a catalyst to a dissolution of families. So I'd be curious as to your responses to that.
All right, I'll be happy to respond to that. What you said is fundamentally insulting to poor people, to imply that poor people can't keep their marriages together and that you have to have money to stay married is nonsense. I can go back to one of the most poor families in the history of mankind, Mary and Joseph, who were fundamental in helping bring Jesus into the world. Extremely poor, so poor that Jesus was born in a barn, yet they succeeded just fine. You don't have to have money. How much money does it take to keep your promise to each other? How much money does it take to say, I will be with you and no one else for the rest of my life? Now, not to say that there aren't stresses and stuff that can come as a result of money or not having money. You know, sure, that can, and I won't ignore that. But, you know, if your relationship is based on, your economy. Well, God forbid we have a bad time in the economy. You know, I'll tell you what, we have been so poor, we couldn't see up. When we got first married, we were essentially hippies. Our first year, we lived in an 8x10 tent. that was our first house for the year. And then we moved up to a little tiny trailer. We traveled around the country. We were just hippies, man. You know, we had nothing, absolutely nothing. But it had no bearing on our marriage, had no bearing on our relationship. Life was tough. We toughed it out together. We were a team together. What happens with economics is when couples start making the other spouse the enemy. You're not earning enough money. You're spending too much money. Right, and you're not working together as a team. Money can amplify that and basically just show the weakness that's already there, lack of trust and that kind of thing. But I promise you, there's a lot of people right now that don't have money. They barely make it. They struggle from paycheck to paycheck. But they love each other. They're committed to each other. They're raising their families. Some of the biggest, most wonderful, solid families in the world, in America today, are, quite frankly, immigrants. Some of them illegal, who have nothing.
Caller, we're down to our last 60 seconds. Do you want to respond for a minute?
Yes. So let me just make sure I understand you correctly. You're suggesting that as an empirical reality, the dissolution of marriages really doesn't have a relationship in the world today with economic stress and economic struggles. I'm not talking about insulting families. I'm talking about an empirical phenomenon. And
yeah.
Are you willing to say that economics and poverty and struggle doesn't matter?
It makes life hard. But either if you make a commitment to a woman, why, because life is hard now, you can't keep that commitment? What does that have to do with anything?
Can I respond to that?
Sure,
yeah.
Respond.
Yeah. the issue that I'm proposing to you is that economics matters in terms of becoming a force and an influence in families and the vibrancy and the health of families. And I find it hard to believe that you could deny that poverty and struggle creates wedges in families as a real core reality in society today.
It depends on your...
We're going to have to leave that at that, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
We are out of time. And let me thank our callers who've raised some very interesting points, and, of course, our guest for the day, Mark Ganger, G-U-N-G-O-R, author of Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the host for Keeping the Faith. Let me make a quick announcement from the Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. There'll be an introductory Arabic course this summer on Saturdays and Wednesday nights. If you have questions, go to their website, arabic@simic.org. Next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Linda Lahovic, a professor of dance. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hummingbirds hum and whales sing next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We hope you'll join us for a summertime special filled with the sounds of the wild. So grab your butterfly net and your binoculars, and we'll help you see the world around you in a whole new way. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. Next time on PRI's The World, rich countries have reliable weather forecasts. They use nationwide networks to monitor changes in the weather. In much of Africa, the weatherman often has to guess. Underfunded weather services mean bad weather ahead for Africa. The Weather Information Divide and the day's news next time on The World. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. here on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
T.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana; and First Federal Savings Bank, Champaign-Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. Remember that.